What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
I hope you're catching up to all of the fascinating people and subjects that we're trying to reveal on America Trends. We look to the future, assessing where we are now and where we're going. New social trends, new political wrinkles in our society. And thus far, we brought you podcasts on the new war on poverty, new ways to fix a broken Washington, D.C., new ways to look at grit, who succeeds and who falls by the wayside. Why life expectancy going forward in America is going down, and new approaches to law and order, among many other things. So we felt that since there's a huge debate in America about real news and fake news, we should look at the future of the print newspaper business. Because if we're going to dig out stories about whether local politicians can be trusted, whether state governments are going to remain solvent, and whether this federal government can be given the enormous responsibility to protect our civil liberties and safety, we better know what the heck is really going on. And for all of our history, it has been the serious and in-depth reporting of print journalists that has been the bulwark against governmental abuse of power. Its importance, of course, no better amplified than the protections granted to a free press in our Bill of Rights. And yet there is no industry, perhaps, buffeted more by the winds of technological change than the broadsheets that hit our doorstep each morning. In putting together this podcast, I can't think of someone better able to describe the changes in the newspaper business than Kevin Convey. Today, he is the chair of the journalism department at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut, but it was a very different route to get there. Now, I can hear some of you now, oh, Larry's bringing us another egghead with no understanding of the real world. Far from it. For nearly 35 years, he toiled in the newspaper business. He did everything that is required to build a reputation. He was a reporter. He worked for a magazine. And then he became a young editor at one of the great newspapers in America, the Boston Herald, and ultimately on to the New York Daily News. At the Daily News, he was put through a crash course in digital disruption as the leader of that newsroom. Kevin, you spoke to Politico a few years back about not leaving the Daily News happily. It was a period of incredible change in the newspaper business. How do you look upon that experience now?
It was a mixed experience, to be sure. I mean, on the one hand, it was tremendously exciting, of course, to be in New York. It was also tremendously exciting in a lot of ways to be running the Daily News during that period of transition. Because it just kind of drew on all of your resources to, try and push this very old-minded organization into the digital future. On the other hand, as at many other places, the human toll of that transition was enormous. I wound up laying off over 100 people while I was there, and it took a huge toll on me. And that's not even to begin to talk about the disagreement between the owner and publisher, Mort Zuckerman, and I about the direction of the paper, which ultimately led to my dismissal. So, it's good stuff and bad stuff. I mean, my wife always says, things happen for a reason, and without some things happening, other things wouldn't happen. And, and that is certainly true in terms of my, hooking on at Quinnipiac and being very, very happy teaching the next generation of journalists.
And we will talk about that. Do you think that kind of turmoil has been present, still is present, in most newsrooms as they try to figure how to transition into this new world?
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And in fact, this past year, this year that we're currently in, was shaping up as one of the worst on record for declines in ad revenues. I think you're seeing some good news from the big organizations like the Washington Post and the New York Times in terms of, what's called the Trump bump in circulation. People are recognizing that, having a trusted source of information is more important than ever, and they're willing to pay for it from big organizations. But when you go down the food chain a little bit to the sort of, metro papers and below, you're finding that they are really suffering and they're continuing to lay off people. And if you look, at the organization, a community news group, which owns more weekly papers and daily papers than anybody else in the country, they are laying off enormous numbers of people. So that is still very much going on. And part of the reason for that is that nobody has found the solution or combination of solutions to be able to float these legacy organizations yet.
You also said in one article that I read that the transition from journalist to teacher, the thing that you missed most was putting page one together. That's the most fun you can have with your clothes on. Tell us why that is. I mean, give us a sense of the excitement in a newsroom on a daily basis, and then we'll get into some of the things that are making it less exciting or at least more disruptive these days.
Well, sure. I mean, and the thing that made it fun while I was doing it is the thing that makes it fun every night. That part of it hasn't changed. It's the resources that it takes to pull it together and whether or not you have them. But imagine this. You have a print newspaper. It has a deadline usually about 9, 10 o'clock, something like that. You have a meeting in the afternoon, say maybe around 5, 6 o'clock, at which you decide which stories appear to be headed for page one. And then they begin to come in, and you look at them, and you shape them, you think of headlines for them, you are thinking about what's your main arc going to be, and you're working with, a couple of people who are highly skilled individuals, highly skilled artists, highly skilled headline writers, graphic artists, men and women, incredible team. The stories are coming in. Sometimes they're perfect and you're incredibly happy. Sometimes they're not what you expected them to be and you have to make a turn. And then oftentimes in that three-hour span from your meeting to the deadline, new things will happen that will cause you to shake up page one. So it's this combination of nervousness, excitement. It draws on all of your skills and experience. It requires, incredibly good judgment, news judgment. It requires the ability to make decisions quickly, to turn the whole scheme upside down if you have to. Many of the time that we would labor through this, 3 or 4 hour period, put out a great page one, and then all of a sudden something would happen after deadline. We'd all have to, sort of get back together again and figure out and do it all over again. So it was just this very, very exciting thing, but it also drew on the wellsprings of your creativity, your ability to recognize and play a good photo, your ability to write a good headline, your ability to, see a good story or take a lesser story and make it into a good story by dint of your editing and coaching of the writer. So it just is the pinnacle of what all journalists kind of work toward if they're interested in being editors.
It would seem that today there are so many other requirements that are put on people in this interactive age and this age where we need to see video, we need to hear audio. So you went back to school to get your master's in entrepreneurial journalism at City University of New York. You were a unique type of student. What is it that the student of today who was sitting alongside you just several years back really has to acquire in terms of skills to make it in that newsroom of the 21st century?
Well, I have to say they need a whole additional layer of skills that we didn't used to have when we started. I mean, frankly, when I started out, I was a liberal arts student. My only newspaper experience was on my during my internships and during my tenure on school newspapers. But I arrived knowing how to write a news story, and I arrived knowing how to handle a 35-millimeter camera. So I could cover my own stories, and I could shoot my own pictures. My pictures weren't great, but they did the job. That was all that was required of me. I mean, besides getting better with experience, that was all that was required of me. When you talk about the young journalist of today, in all likelihood, they are going to a website, not to a print operation. If it is a print operation, because they're young and they know the technical aspects, they're probably going on the website. That means that they need a whole additional layer of skills. So they need to know how to shoot and edit video. They've still got to be able to write well and write headlines. They've got to have knowledge of digital layout. They need to know social media, because social media is how you find and develop your audiences and promote your stories. And it helps if they have some grasp of using data to create charts and graphs, data visualization skills. So there's this whole layer of technical skills that didn't exist 30 years ago that students are now required to have. And in addition to that, what's very interesting is that, you know, I mean, us old guys, I mean, we would go, you know, on the, you know, go work at the paper, show up at 7 o'clock. We had worked an AM paper, which came out around noon. So, you know, I would work like the Dickens between 7 and 10. My deadline was at 10 o'clock. The paper hit the streets at noon. I went and you know, did reporting for the next day, quit about 5. And that was it. It came in the next day and did it again. Students who start today, they have a deadline every nanosecond. I hesitate even to call it a news cycle because it's not a news cycle anymore. It doesn't cycle. Mm. It doesn't cease. It's a maelstrom. So the requirements on young journalism students are far greater than they were in my time, and the demands are much greater as well. And unfortunately, the remuneration hasn't gotten any better than it was when I first started out at $175 a week.
Absolutely. I mean, what suffers in this process? Because it seems as if we're looking for somebody to be able to do a lot of things when the most important thing was to be able to really go in, understand a complex story, and interpret it for an audience. Today, though, there are so many other requirements. Does one thing or another have to suffer?
I think because you have to train students to do a lot of different things that you're not able to give them the reps that, you know, they might need to have on investigative reporting, deep reporting, you know, that sort of stuff. And I also think, you know, so there's that aspect in the education, and then the aspect in the trade is that, you know, you're so busy that taking the time to dig into a story is really a big sacrifice. And so you see less and less of that at the lower echelons of the trade, even though the big organizations like the Washington Post and the New York Times, of course, still continue to do it. So I think that, you know, the deep reporting suffers, the you know, giving people additional reps at different things. I mean, we hit all the, you know, all of the areas. They know something about investigative reporting. But there because you have to teach them so much, there isn't a lot of time to go as deep as you might have been able to go in the past.
Well, there's a lot of innovation, of course, born out of disruption in the news business. How well have the lessons been learned in the industry, and who's built one of the better models to demonstrate the possibilities in this digital era?
Well, I don't think that there's any question that the Washington Post is the absolute leader in technology-driven journalism. You know, so I think if you want to look at, you know, a paper that is, you know, it's making a profit. We don't know. It's not a publicly traded corporation. It's owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't know how much of a profit, but they say they're making a profit, and they're putting together a spectacular report, and they're doing investigative reporting. You know, they seem to be doing everything right. The real problem, as I mentioned earlier, is that model's fine for a paper that's national and to some degree international, and, you know, is already at scale. The real problem is trying to leverage that on the other end, where, just by the by, most people actually get their news. Most people actually get their news from smaller outlets, from weeklies and dailies and radio stations and TV stations, local TV stations. And while, you know, TV and radio aren't doing all that poorly right now, what happened to newspapers will happen to them if they don't make the digital switch quickly enough. So what I'm not worried about the survival of the Washington Post, which is doing a bang-up job, or the survival of the New York Times, or even USA Today. I'm not worried about that. What I'm really worried about is the survival of the papers in the middle. I think the weekly papers, because they're usually run as an act of love on a shoestring, often by people, you know, community members who just really like to do it. Mm-hmm. I think they're safe, and I also think they're safe because community newspapers provide a level of coverage that you just cannot get anywhere else. You can't, you know, find out about the police law. You can't find out about, you know, the school lunch. You can't get the, you know, court records, that sort of stuff. And when I say papers, I don't mean just papers, but hyperlocal websites, of which there are plenty, too. I think they will survive, but looking at titles like, the Boston Globe or papers even smaller than that that cover a cluster of towns, they're in for really heavy sledding. And I'm not sure that, I'm just not sure that there's a future for them.
And what's the toughest thing for them to get right about the way people are consuming the news in those communities? It used to be, of course, Kevin, when it hit the front door, I mean, there was a lot to devour, and there was a lot about our local community that we couldn't get in any other way. What is it today that they have to assume when they're composing that front page?
I think the real problem is that it's not a coverage problem. It's a business problem. There's a lot of theories floating around about how we ought to cover the news. And one of the, the newest theories, most recent theories, is something called, social news gathering. And that is when you go into a community and you do an information inventory and you ask people what kind of news and information they need, and then, prescribe, what it is you're covering to their needs. I think those kinds of problems can be easily solved. The real tough nut is the business model, and that is, a business model in which advertising paid, something like 65% or 70% of the bill. And what wound up happening, of course, is that as circulation began to decline and as advertisers discovered that they could get the same kind of bang for the buck on the web in a form that was cheap, that was verifiable, basically limitless, they began to abandon print operations. And print operations, in addition to having this reliance on advertising, that's very hard to get that money, that much money in any other way. In addition to that, they also have all these legacy costs. So, your hyperlocal website does not have to run a fleet of trucks. It does not have to run a printing press. It does not have to, heat a factory. It does not have to buy ink. It does not have to buy paper. All of it, it does not have ginormous pensions that stem from, that great era of the 50s and 60s when everybody got a pension. So it's the business model. And so what the challenge that faces them is a way to try to shrink their operations in a way that won't kill their news gathering, which is very, very difficult on the one hand.
Isn't that the variable that they can play with? Because some of these backroom operations have to be sustained at current levels.
Yes. Well, absolutely. Why is it that hyperlocal, websites and small newspapers work? Because usually you only have one or two employees, and often, there'll be a married couple or something like that living on a shoestring and doing it as a labor of love. Love don't help you win at the track, somebody once famously said. If you have a bunch of employees, you've got to pay them. And back in the 60s and 70s, one of the ways that you paid them and attracted them was with fixed pensions, which are enormously expensive. And, so what I'm getting at is that you have all these costs, and where you wind up feeling like you have to cut is the news gathering. So I don't know about what your local paper is, but, I'm sure that you have noticed that it's so light when you lift it off the doorstep, you could basically fall over and pick it up.
The Monday edition is wafer thin, and we noticed that. I've got to ask you for an example, and I'd love to pet it back in your backyard. You today are the chairman of the journalism department at Quinnipiac, and that is located in Hamden, Connecticut. You've got the New Haven Register in your backyard and the New Haven Independent. And as a case study, how well does this epitomize the future in the industry where you've got a very agile operation in the New Haven Independent and a legacy newspaper like the New Haven Register?
I think it is shaping up to be the journalistic battle of this age, truthfully. I think you're finding it in every community where you've got, we have a paper here in Brockton, Mass., where I have a home. Long-time local newspaper, legacy paper, and they are being battled, and beaten to the punch a lot of times by a small hyper-local website called The Spark. Same situation that you see setting up in New Haven. And, there are certain things that the big operations will have going for them. They've got, sort of geographical spread, and they've got some scale and stuff like that. But what they don't have, the word that you used is a good one, what they don't have is that nimbleness that ability to move quickly from one thing to the next, and to build and grow slowly. In other words, the task of a place like the New Haven Register is to get smaller. The task of a place like the New Haven Register is to grow at the right, the right rate, so that, you know, that that's sustainable. It's much easier, as you know, to grow in business than it is, you know, to skinny down. What's the old saying? You know, how do you get a small business?
Start with a large one.
And wait. That's right. Exactly. Start with a large one and wait. And that's particularly true in journalism these days.
There was a study of online readership about a year back, and the online readership of 51 leading regional newspapers was going down compared to their performance in 2011. I found that counterintuitive. What's at play here?
I'm not sure. You know, there are some people who are saying that there is a resurgence in print, that people are finding that kind of in line with this idea of trustworthy operations, that there is a solidity to print, almost a solemnity, if you will, in some ways, and that this is driving people toward print products and away from online. But, you know, I think the other thing that's going on is I think people's, you know, sort of taste in journalism is atomizing. In other words, I don't think they're going to, you know, the big online sites as much as they are going to other kind of niche sites. And I think that, you know, that's part of the reason why we're so divided in this country right now, is that, you know, everybody, not everybody, but many people seek out the news that confirms their view of the world. And the internet has made it possible that you can conceivably find a website that suits your view of the world perfectly. And, you know, you need not ever challenge your thinking, either your political thinking or anything else, by subjecting it, you know, to opinions that you don't agree with. So I think that people's tastes are spreading out. I'm not sure that they're abandoning the online form so much as, you know, they are just not going to the bigger sites in the way that they did.
But we did think that brand was going to translate wherever it went. If it was the Washington Post or the New York Times, if it was branded with their indicia, then we thought, well, everybody would want to go and find that wherever it is, because that is reliable content. Have some of these online providers, where they only live online, Politico, Daily Beast, Daily Caller, Breitbart, have they a keener understanding of how to project themselves in that space, and leaving some of the more traditional brands behind?
Oh, I think so. I think that's without a doubt. I mean, you know, digital natives, they don't have to think about doing this stuff. Now, on the one hand, they don't have to think about how to do it, which, you know, a lot of non-digital natives or legacy operations have to, or they have to go hire some younger people to figure it out for them. But they also have this other advantage where they don't have to worry about putting out a print product either, which is, you know, I can tell you from 35 years of doing it, it's an enormous stretch all by itself to do that. So, yeah, I think it's twofold. I think you're absolutely right in that they have a better idea of how to operate in that mode. But I also think, you know, the print operations have an additional responsibility that, you know, that's really grinding. And I also think, you know, to the idea of brand, I mean, I think you're quite right. I do think it translates. I mean, I think, you know, wherever you go, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times are known, and they have sort of a very solid reputation, and it's worldwide. But it's the places that don't. It's the Brockton Enterprises, the New Bedford Standard Times, you know. Those places that do not. That's what I worry about.
You talked earlier about the ad subscription model. Are there changes that are going on or that must occur to accelerate how they tinker with this model, augment it, replace it altogether, if in fact the whole online component is not the one that's going to drive them to a new level of profitability or the old level of profitability?
What we're trying to do is to wean our customers off of news that's subsidized by advertising. I think there are two parts of this puzzle. You know, the first is online advertising is not especially good. It's especially annoying is what it is. Because, you know, when you're looking at a newspaper, if you don't like an advertisement, you just flip the page and move on to the content. You know, I mean, go to your average website and, you know, try and watch a video without getting 30 seconds of pre-roll. before you can watch your video. You can watch your video in 15 seconds. That's an eternity on the web, and that frustrates people. The other thing that frustrates people, and I'm not sure how effective it is, but it frustrates them, are these ads that creep around behind you and talk to you on the website. So we have taken something that was a help to readers in the virtual age of newspapers, and we've turned it into an irritant. So is it any wonder that it doesn't seem to be working? So I think on the one hand, let's look at the audience side, let's look at the advertising side. If you look at the audience side, you have to get people to accept the fact that news is something worth paying for, even though they have to get over the fact that there's lots of news around and that they didn't used to have to pay a lot for it before. They have to pay for it now without getting a tangible print item in return. So there's that battle and the whole, you know, struggle over whether or not paywalls are good or bad or micropayments or however you do. Then on the other hand, you have to reform advertising. You have to make advertising into something really useful and non-irritating. And, you know, those are two very tall orders.
Absolutely. You know, recently, Kevin, I was watching again the movie Spotlight, and I was struck by the importance of an outsider coming into the Boston Globe, and you have a lot of experience in that market, and noticing that the most important story of its time had escaped the attention of local reporters. And perhaps that's because it was so explosive, or the coziness with institutions of power that you may not want to come into conflict with. But is there a greater challenge today in terms of looking away at some of these power centers in communities because bottom lines are receding?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think there's a trend, you know, to want to try and keep the boat afloat, and that means that maybe there is less of a tendency to rock the boat when you might put an advertiser's nose out of joint. I think that the other thing that plays into this is, you know, there is a dissolving, there used to be something called the Chinese wall between editorial and advertising. It just was never surmounted. And, you know, journalists felt very, very uncomfortable, you know, dealing with business matters. I think that was a mistake. I think we were, as journalists, horrible, horrible stewards of our own businesses. And, you know, I like to tell my students that the business of journalism is too important to leave in the hands of business types alone, because the smartest people in journalism, let's face it, are journalists. But I also have to say that the fact that that wall is dissolving, that there isn't a firewall in between business concerns and journalism, means that journalists are going to feel heightened business pressure when business, you know, instincts, I mean, when business matters are at risk. So I absolutely feel that, you know, this is a tougher time. Because you're less insulated from, you know, from business concerns than you ever have been.
In this era of fake news and calls for the failing New York Times to stop reporting on the new president, is this a point for reassertion of the principles upon which newspapers were built, their singular importance? I see these T-shirts coming out saying, you know, remember, you know, the importance of speaking truth to power. Is this a moment in time that really can benefit what has been a failing business model?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I tell people over and over again, and they look at me like I'm absolutely nuts, but, you know, I think the current era and the current president is going to be great for journalists. You know, the thing is that journalists are all upset. Oh, you know, the president talks about it. You know, he talks about it negatively. He's going to war again, blah, blah, blah. Let's just scroll back and think about the state of the press in the 19th century and the 20th century until Watergate. The press was roundly criticized. The press was considered to be a bunch of scurrilous, you know, rumor mongers and so on and so forth. The press, I mean, even Thomas Jefferson, who was such an advocate of the press, hated the press, said horrible things about the press, and they treated him horribly as well. Then all of a sudden, Watergate comes along. The business gets professionalized. The Washington Post deposes a criminal president. And all of a sudden, the esteem in which journalists are held, you know, just soars. And everybody thinks, this is great. We are great. You know, people love us, and it's terrific, and so on and so forth. But guess what, buddy? That was a bubble. That was just a bubble. And I'll tell you something else. That bubble is now over, and we can go back to being the in-your-face, asking unpleasant questions, nobody's pal, if your mother says she loves you, check it out, type people that we're supposed to be. And I also think that the fact that we are, you know, under attack from the right and from the president may help us to refocus our priorities on where they truly need to be. And that is very simple. As an editor of mine, you know, once said, get the news, put it in the paper. Get the news, put it in the paper, which is another way of saying seek the truth and publish it. That's our basic job. And maybe we ought to spend more time thinking about that and less time thinking about existential threats to our existence.
Do you think that this perhaps is a reinvigorating period, not only for those who are covering Washington, D.C. and Donald Trump, but people being reminded in local newspapers where they felt put upon in this recent period with all the cutbacks and the like to get them motivated again?
Oh, I do. I think everybody, you know, the great thing about the press is it's always up for a good fight. I mean, you know, it retains that combative instinct. The best reporters do. And, you know, if somebody comes along, whether it's the president or the janitor, and sticks a thumb in your eye, you're going to fight back. Now, I would strongly recommend that we fight back, you know, in an ethical way, that, you know, we tell the truth, we ask the tough questions, we try to, you know, tell both sides of the story. You know, we try to give what we call a fair report. But, you know, if somebody wants to, you know, rattle the cages, I think that's good. And I think that could, you know, really sort of refocus our attention on what's important, on the eternal verities of the business.
What about some of the experiments that have taken place? Certain newspapers that were publishing only a couple of days a week and the rest of the week you had to go online. What are some of the creative responses to all the disruption? And have they been played out? Are there new approaches being taken?
There are new approaches every day, but most of the ones that are working in any way have to do with distribution via social media platforms. I mean, that really seems to be where the action is. That and video. You know, there is an absolutely insatiable appetite among news consumers for video. So much so that newsrooms, you know, particularly in their diminished state, can't provide the amount of video that their business sides could sell. So that's one thing, you know, a concentration on video and making sure that there's plenty of video to sell against. That's thing one. And thing two is, you know, the whole idea about using new apps and using new social media platforms to both reach toward audiences, but also to prospect for audiences, to find audiences, and then to promote stories. You know, the business about shrinking down from 7 days to four, or skipping the days where there aren't a lot of advertising. I mean, my sense of that is that was a desperation move to save money. You know, it really wasn't an innovative move designed to make things better. That's like the, oh, yeah, for your inconvenience, we'll only give you your paper 3 days a week. Mm. Yeah, thanks. Oh, that's a great improvement in my life. So you know, I think that was a terrified response to how badly things were going financially. And I don't see any future in it. However, I do see the possibility that what could happen is that some of these regional papers just wind up becoming digital operations because they simply can't afford to manufacture and distribute the paper every day. And the problem there is that even now, 50% of the revenues from most newspapers come from the print side. You know, even as bad as advertising has gotten and circulation has gotten, you still throw off revenue that's really hard to recoup in other ways when you don't have a paywall.
Do you think that the worst of the hits that newspapers have taken in this period have already occurred and that they've settled into a new normal? And if so, what is that normal?
I don't even think we're close. I don't even think we're close to seeing the end of it because, as I said, this year is shaping up to be the worst year for advertising revenues of any year since, you know, digital, you know, sort of broke out.
Even though the economy seems to be coming back a bit.
It does, even though it's coming back. You know, it's not economy-related, I don't think. I think what it's related to is the fact that advertisers have found that they can, you know, get a better deal by aiming their, you know, advertising toward the web. and not, you know, not toward paper. So I'm not sure there's anything that can be done about that. And I think there's going to be, you know, I don't think it's going to affect the big papers that we're talking about, but I think there's going to be a die-off of, you know, of regional papers as they slowly find that what they're not just in a period of adjustment, but they're actually in a death spiral where, you know, they cut and cut and cut, and as they cut, their product becomes less attractive. As their product becomes less attractive, they draw fewer readers and can't get the paywall revenue that they want because people say it's not worth paying for. And they draw fewer advertisers because advertisers are saying, well, just look at this thing. Do you want to be associated with this? You know, this thing that, you know, lands on your doorstep with a whisper?
What happens generally when chains buy up these mid-sized dailies? That's occurred in most places. What's the history of what they do with the paper?
Not a pretty one in the modern era. I mean, it used to be that your big concern about chain ownership was this sort of uniformity of political views and this whole idea of monopoly and stuff like that. We used to fret about that. We don't fret about that anymore in chain ownership. We're actually happy that somebody wants to buy something in this besotted industry of ours. The problem really is that the way in which those sales proceed is, you know, even the best chain, they go in, they buy, and then they cut. In some cases, they leverage the economies of scale. Sometimes they have central copy editing and layout operations and things like that. In some cases, they don't. But I can guarantee you this. Nobody who ever saw their newspaper get sold to a chain thought that the paper was better after the chain bought it than it was before it did. Local ownership is always better because it's their baby. For the chain, it's just another number. And you see this with all the chains. There wouldn't be any reason to buy it if they didn't think that they could, you know, absolutely gut it and then make some money.
In Connecticut, there's a nonprofit model. There are a couple of them, of course, but CT Mirror, and they do a lot of really serious investigative work with the grant model that they have. Is that a sustainable model?
Well, I think it is, but here's the problem. I think it's worth trying, and certainly Texas Tribune kind of pioneered this down in Texas, where they have a business model that is A, nonprofit, B, it's kind of public-spirited, C, it holds all kinds of events that people will, you know, pay to come to, so they have a lot of different revenues. The problem with nonprofit is that you still got to raise money. You know, it's not like all of a sudden your money woes are over. You just got to raise it in a different way. And here's my concern in some ways about the nonprofit model in the age of Trump. You know, if all of a sudden all of these government grants dry up, I think that you're going to see, you know, nonprofits, not just news nonprofits, but all kinds of nonprofits really struggle because, you know, they have been getting, you know, grants that are government related, and those are, you know, those are going to dry up, and the foundations are going to have more demand. And perhaps won't be able to, you know, to donate as much. Now, I'm not bad-mouthing the business model. I don't have a problem with, you know, with the nonprofit thing. But I think if we're ever going to solve this issue, we're going to have to figure out a way to make a pay, because I don't see all of the news industry going nonprofit. I think there's just got to be a way through reforming advertising, re-educating the consumer, refocusing ourselves on what's important, and keeping our eye on the prize in the age of Trump and fake news. You know, I think something is going to come out of that. I'm not hopeless. I just think it's going to take time.
If you and I were having this conversation in, say, 2030, what in your mind would be left of the print model best represented by a healthy newspaper industry going back, say, 15, 20 years?
Well, I think you'll still have the big papers. I think you'll still have, you know, obviously I think you'll have the Times. I think you'll have the Post, the Washington Post. I think you'll have the LA Times. You'll have a few more. I think that their print circulation will have continued to decline, and in some ways the print publication will be a prestige publication. So the Journal, I should mention the Journal, because the Journal is important role to play in all of that. So I think that, you know, in saying that it's going to be a prestige thing to have a print newspaper, like a magazine, and you'll wind up paying for it like a magazine. I couldn't believe it the last time I went to buy a copy of the New Yorker on the newsstand. It was $8.95. you know, you're going to see newspapers that cost that much in our lifetime. You will see that. And that's because on the other end, their digital circulation will be growing. I think you will have seen a massive die-off of regional newspapers. And I think that you will see an explosion in the number of hyperlocal websites and single-focus websites. So websites that are focused on politics, like, you know, Politico, websites that are focused on the environment, websites that are focused on different ethnicities, different interests, those kinds of things. I think things that are organized in less in a general interest way can survive. But, you know, I think the problem with that model is that there are huge holes to fill. For example, who is going to cover the State House? Your hyperlocal website isn't going to cover the State House. Your New York Times isn't going to cover the State House on, you know, on Beacon Hill in Boston. So, you know, maybe you wind up with, you know, with an Associated Press-like organization that does that and feeds it out. The only problem, of course, is the Associated Press lives because of the subscription of regional newspapers.
Yeah, I think people don't realize that that is the model. What about City Hall and the coverage of City Hall? Use that term euphemistically across the country.
Yeah, no, I think that City Hall, you'll get coverage of City Hall because you have, for example, you have 7 weekly newspapers in Boston, and, you know, 3 or 4 of them cover, you know, City Hall related to their neighborhood. I think you'll get coverage of City Hall because it's local. For example, the Spark, which covers Brockton, covers City Hall, you know, covers the meetings and all that type of stuff. I think you'll get that. I think what's really worrisome is the regional stuff. The entire state government, which, you know, in Massachusetts is a cesspool of corruption, you know, will go, if this happens, if my prediction is correct, and I hope I'm wrong for once, you know, will go completely unchecked, you know, and unreported on. It's already beginning. When I was at the State House Bureau for the Boston Herald in the early 80s, there must have been 30 reporters in there. If you go in there now, there's one from the Associated Press, one from the Globe. The Herald doesn't maintain a bureau anymore. And then there are some assorted, you know, smaller papers in there, and that's it. So, you know, and so that's already underway.
Well, you're looking into the faces of the future of journalism with all the students at Quinnipiac University. How hopeful are you, and how excited are you to send them out into this world?
Hopeful and excited, because I think, on the one hand, it's a harder world that I went into. You know, it's harder personally because you don't have the same deal. You know, you don't have the same kind of, you know, guaranteed pension and all that, guaranteed hours and all that sort of stuff, on the one hand. But where there is disruption, there is always tremendous opportunity. And I think that if you can produce students who have a great work ethic, who can write, shoot, and edit in, you know, video and in print, and who are ready to go out and roll with the punches, you know, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful for their prospects. I mean, I look at, you know, Quinnipiac's record in placing, you know, placing its students, and it's exceptional. I mean, it, you know, it's the you know, class of 2014, 90% of them were either working or in grad school 6 months out of 6 months after graduation. So, you know, so that's good. So I'm very hopeful. But, you know, is it going to be easy for them? No, not going to be easy at all.
I thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. I think you've really given us an insight into where we are and where we're going, and that's exactly what we're trying to do on this podcast. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about something I love and to talk with somebody who is so obviously well-prepared.
Oh, thank you, Kevin.